Good, good. Thanks for that that letter there, Jim. It was very nice.
Oh, thank you, Rabbi.
I'm glad you had the wherewithal, the confidence, and the security in your own knowledge to realize that what you heard over there at that conference was really just complete nonsense. Actually, I was talking yesterday about a friend about that idea, it's an old Hasidic idea, and I'm surprised it's still around, but evidently they just latch on to these things and they do not let go, like you're mentioning that God is everywhere, this concept of pantheism, that God fills everything. They have this impossibility of viewing, that they're trying to make God holier, so to speak, than he is. They're trying to say that God is everything. So that they feel they're attributing greatness to God by saying that. So by making that first error, is saying that God is everything. So this way, they're forced to say that even sin is something which God must occupy, because they're looking at God in a physical manner, in a geographical type of manner, meaning that since God is everything, meaning in terms of every space, so then they throw sin into this realm of things that occupy space or occupies the universe in a physical way, something which is, has mass. So God must be in sin too, because since nothing could be, everything must be God, there's nothing outside of God. So then they make that statement that God's even in sin. And the early Hasidic movement, some of them held that therefore, that since God is even inside sin, so it's okay for a righteous person, a tzaddik, as they call him, to be involved in sin, because that'll catapult them to even higher levels, which of course is a complete contradiction, because they're only saying he can go into sin because he'll get out of it. Well, if God's in sin, why do you want to get out of it? So there's just a number of contradictions and ridiculous ideas, but they're not thinking. They come up with this one idea that God's everything, and then they have to preserve that at all costs, even at the cost of being irrational. So the one mistake leads to another. Actually, Maimonides, in the Guide for Perplexed, maybe we'll take a look at it. He talks about this very mistake, and he talks about how people make an error, and they say that since they look at something how it is now, so since it is that way now, it must always have been that way. And the example Maimonides gives that to illustrate this error is that if you take a child, a boy, and let's say he's on an island, I think he says there's just men, there's no women on the island, and of course a kid doesn't remember prior to the age of two or one, whatever it is, and you tell the child that at a certain point you were enclosed, you did not breathe air, you didn't excrete, you were not doing an act of eating or breathing, and you were in this state for 9 months. So he'll tell you that's ridiculous, because you look at the way a person can't live that way. A person needs air, he needs food, he needs to excrete, he needs to move around. And the boy's error is coming from looking at the current state of human and assuming that's how it always was. So Maimonides is showing that just like there's an error there, because in fact, the embryo doesn't have the same existence as a human being does now. So also the people that look at the world now, their error is that they see that everything is physical. It comes from something. It comes from something physical. There's some physical cause to everything that we see now. So that means everything physical had to have been, come from something physical. But they don't realize that at the beginning of creation, that's not how it worked. Because at the beginning of creation, there was nothing physical. So that first physical matter did not operate the same way things do today. So that's the same problem with Hasidim, that they make a statement based on how they see things now. They see things now that everything is physical. Everything occupies space. And they look at the entire world this way, but they throw God into that. And they say he also takes up space. That's why they have this other ludicrous idea of contraction called tzimtzum, that God had to contract himself to make room for the universe, as if God is actually taking up the space. And since God filled everything, as they believe, so when the universe came into existence, well, that had to have some location where could God put this universe. That since God was filling up everything, so he had to contract himself to make room for the universe. So you see, they have the inability to go past a certain mode of thinking. But you know, it's an old idea. Actually, say it's an old foolishness, not an idea. But you know, Maimonides takes that up, and it's that the infantile state where they can't, you know, get out of, that forces them to try to fit everything into the notions, as opposed to abandoning it when they realize it is false.
Did they address Maimonides? Do they address the Sadia Gaon? Because I've read a little bit of his arguments regarding the oneness of God, and he and Maimonides and the author of Duties of the Heart, whose name is slipping from my mind, I know that all of them make quite clear that God, of course, cannot be physical. If he had any physicality, he would have parts, and then the parts would be prerequisite to his existence, and therefore he would not be the first mover. Do they address these things at all?
They can't. They really can't. I mean, they're just working with corrupt ideas. So, because that's at their foundation, and that's what they're trying to preserve, they won't budge from it.
Rabbi?
Yeah.
Isn't that similar to the theory that some have the idea the foolishness of that we all have a God within us?
Yeah, same thing. It's, you know, it's part of their whole thinking.
Right, okay.
Rabbi?
Yes, Doug.
Is this related to an idea that I had seen, and I think I have it accurately, that the position is held that everything that happens is the will of God, therefore you do have free will, but if you sin, then that sin was the will of God, and therefore you shouldn't feel bad about it?
I'm not sure if it's related. I've heard that. I think actually, Jim, I think is that was part you had written me, right?
Mine was actually a little bit different, but I do see a through line between those two ideas. Like, one would, what Doug is saying, it seems like it has to be the logical conclusion. Because if everything that happens to you is from God, then that sin that somebody else performs against you was part of God's will, and therefore God had to be willing to sin, which I think you addressed in a chapter of your book.
Yes, exactly. If you say that everything is planned by God, so then that means even sin, and that means that the person should be exempt who sinned against you. But that's a contradiction, because God says in his Torah not to sin. So, again, one the foolishness leads to another. Maimonides clearly addresses that in the Guide for Perplexed. And the bottom line, and he says it in other places too. That, for example, he says that a person marries a good woman, so that's a mitzvah, that's a command. And God does not legislate the fulfillment of commands. That's part of your free will, and that's why you receive reward. Because you did it, not God. Conversely, if a person marries a woman who's not a good person, so that would be a sin. And God also does not legislate sin. And so either way you go, man has free will. But the simplest thing is a person knows that, you know, a person could stop and do an experiment and decide whether he's going to pick up that pen or not right now. If a person wants to abandon his thinking, he'll say, yes, God wants me to do it. I mean, even the most foolish things, yes, God wants this leaf out of the trillions of leaves that's falling right now, that the angle of the descent and the speed of the descent of this leaf and the timing that the leaf falls from the tree, all these things which really have no effect whatsoever, but they they're forced into saying that all these things are needed, and it's God's will, and you don't have support for that anyway. In fact, it discredits God's ability to create a system that can operate. If you're saying that every single thing has to be God doing it every single moment, and the truth also, it throws God into the sphere of time, and time is something which is created. God's not controlled by his creations. So to say that God has to do something at every moment is false. It goes against reality. And on top of that, you have a Mishnah in the Ethics of the Fathers that says that God created all the miracles at the beginning of time. So that means that everything was planted into the laws at the time of creation. And as time unfolds in our realm where we experience time, so then based on the design that it was created, that's when the miracle unfolds precisely at the right moment, because God knows exactly how to build something that it has its own internal alarm clock, and then it'll go off at the right moment. So there's numerous problems with it, and the real emotion that propels a person to say this is the desire not to have any responsibility. God's doing everything. So,
Rabbi?
When I sin, he's also doing it too, so why should I get punished? Yes?
Yeah, Rabbi, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. That goes totally against, if we have that theory, if we go with that idea, that goes totally against what you taught us, then that takes away our free will. We have the free will.
Right.
Everything is by the hand of God except our freedom of choice.
Right.
So we have freedom of choice.
Right. It goes against that rabbinic statement too. The Gemara says, the Talmud says, that everything is in the hands of heaven except for the fear of heaven. So the actual Talmud says that the fear of God, which means fulfillment of God's word and sinning, is in man's hand.
Right. Right.
Yep.
We have to take responsibility.
Yeah, of course.
If it isn't God doing it, we're doing it. Otherwise, where would be the benefit? We would have the benefits of getting credit for doing something good.
Right.
Yes. Thank you.
Okay, so let's take a look at Hellas. We are, unless there's any other questions on that, any other points?
I just walked in shortly after the conversation started. Are you? Was the discussion about Hasidus?
Hasidus, yeah.
Okay. Do you have any sense of how, if you look at the whole universe of Orthodox Jewry, what percentage of that is Hasidic?
Don't know offhand. I know it's only a few hundred years old, just like Reform and Conservative, you know, movements come about.
Thanks.
I'm sure these are old notions. I'm sure they, you know, the time of the Egyptian culture, they had this too, reincarnation. And now, you know, the modern day extremists and the Jews, they have this thing called Gilgal, which is just the same term, reincarnation. So there are certain emotions that, you know, everybody, every human is the same, is identical. And these emotions are going to become expressed in every generation. And, you know, the clothing might be different, the culture, what the person looks like might be different, but it's all the same. Like King Solomon says, there's nothing new under the sun. Man was never reinvented. So whatever we'll see today, these emotions they're old. They're as old as man.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Yeah, just to continue on that thought, in reference to Hasidus, each group, there's different groups, each group has their own Rebbe, their own Rabbi, who they follow. Whereas when somebody is Orthodox, not belonging to a Hasidic group, they think for themselves, they learn for themselves, they have a Rabbi they learn with, but they're still thinking for themselves. It's not that something that the Rabbi says, do it my way, do it this way, this is what the group will do, and this is what we believe in. Everybody has their own patterns. And
well, the rabbi is always the one to go to for rulings of law. Doesn't matter what group you're in. I mean, that's part of the Torah.
Oh.
Right, that's Deuteronomy 17:11. It says that you should follow the rabbis. They're the ones that have the right, but only in as much as they're telling you Torah law. There may be more of a deification of the rabbi, the Rebbe, and other groups. But the rabbi is definitely first is intelligent that they had that status. So that community, every Jewish community, Orthodox,
right.
That's proper. But, in that area, the Hasidim are not making a mistake in that.
No. If they go to the extent of saying that if one person within that community wants to pray at a different synagogue, they can without fighting with the person?
So, that's not a halachic area.
Okay.
And a rabbi can't legislate upon the person either. It's only the person seeks out a answer.
Right. Okay, so I'm just thinking in terms of there was an issue that occurred.
Yeah, I know.
I think, okay, thank you.
Okay. All right. So, Rivka, was anything else wanted to add or no?
No. That's you know about the incident that I was talking about, and I was just wondering. But you cleared it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. So we're now in chapter 10 of Koheles, and we have an interesting verse. All right, so last week we talked about how the heart of the wise person is always at the intelligence is always there. It's accompanying the person who's wise, and it's in his right, meaning to say it's ready to be used, his intelligence, in anything which he approaches in life. And conversely, the fool, he is so foolish, meaning to say that if you don't have intelligence, the only other faculty that, there's two primary faculties. There's a lot of sub-faculties. You have intelligence on the one side, and then your instincts on the other side. And within instincts, there's numerous, instinctual drives. But if a person's just not following intelligence categorically, so then he has to be acting emotionally. There's nothing else. So, and a person who's like that, King Solomon says in 10:3, that even on the path that the fool goes, his heart is lacking, and it's as if he's telling everybody, I'm a fool. Meaning his way in life is so apparently corrupt and foolish. It's as if he's, telling people that I'm a fool. That's how apparent it is. And we said, why does it have to say that? It's like he's telling everybody. Why does it just say that he is? He's acting like a fool. What's the concept of telling? We underline that as being something which is an additional point in that verse. So we said that when you tell somebody, that means now you're involved in the social, as opposed to just acting. A person acts foolish, so that's not a social phenomenon. He could be acting foolish on his own, independently, isolated from others. But the fact that King Solomon says that the person who is foolish, he goes about, and on his way, his heart is lacking, and he says to everybody that he's a fool. So saying to everybody means that despite the need for dignity that a person typically has, a person is so foolish is going to even cross that line. And even the typical need for dignity, he doesn't even hold on to. As if he's telling people that he's a fool. So I thought we mentioned that last week. Okay, so the verse we're up to now is as follows. Let's read it. We're now up to 10:4, and it says as follows. If the spirit of the anger of a ruler rises up against you, from your place do not budge. Because it is a healing thing of many sins against you. Because deference, if you give deference, you pay respect to this ruler, it can heal many sins. Meaning it can resolve the issue, resolve the problem. And there's Ibn Ezra on this. But let's just understand the verse. The verse says, and also the juxtaposition. I mean, up to this point, we've been pretty good track record we have in terms of seeing how the verses follow and how they flow. But here, all of a sudden, he's bringing in this concept of a ruler. If the anger of a ruler rises up against you, don't budge from your place, because deference can placate great sins. So you have two cases in the Torah that immediately come to mind. One is where, of course, Jacob was being chased by his twin brother Esav, and Esav had 400 men with him, and Jacob feared that he was now going to finally be wiped out, so he split the camp in two. So if he gets one, at least half the people will survive, because he took the birthright rightfully, but in Esav's mind, he was still angry about it. And all this time, Jacob feared that Esav was going to kill him. So Jacob had bowed down to him and approached him very politically and gave him gifts. So you see how giving deference to Esav had an effect. And he ended up not killing him. And similarly, when King Saul was chasing after David there were numerous accounts, numerous times this happened. And David at one point found Saul, and they were sleeping, and he went into the cave where Saul was, and he cut off a piece of his garment, and then he went away. And it says this is in the Samuel 1, chapter 24, verse 9. And he said, after that, David arose and stepped out of the cave, calling after King Saul, saying, "My lord, the king." And Saul looked behind him, and David bowed down his face to the ground, and he prostrated himself. David said to Saul, "Why do you listen to the words of someone who says, 'Behold, David seeks harm to you'? Behold, this day your eyes have seen that Hashem delivered you into my hand in the cave today, and although someone said to kill you, my soul took pity on you, and I said, I shall not send forth my hand against my lord Saul, for he is the anointed of God. See now, my father." So you see, David calls Saul his father. He says, "See now, my father, indeed, see the corner of your coat that is in my hand. For since I have cut off the corner of your coat, and I have not killed you," I mean, he's trying to show King Saul that he had the ability. He had a knife in his hand. He was right next to him while he was sleeping, and he didn't harm him. But you see, he bowed down to him, and he called him father. And he says, "See that I cut off the corner of your coat, but I did not kill you. I have not sinned against you, yet you hunt my soul to take it. May God judge between me and you, and may God avenge me from you. But my hand will not act against you." So King David is testifying to the fact that he is not, despite the fact that Saul is trying to kill David, so David is not going to retaliate. And David says, as the ancient proverb says, "Wickedness issues from the wicked, but my hand will not act against you. After whom has the king of Israel gone out? Who are you trying to pursue after someone as insignificant as a dead dog, as a single flea?" You see what David's doing. He's calling himself like a dead dog, like a single flea. And he bows down to him, and he calls Saul his father. So again, you see an example of what this case is, of what the King Solomon is saying, that if the anger of a ruler rises up against you, don't budge from your place, but deference can resolve the issue. So you see what he did is that he completely diffused the situation. And he knew that by showing himself as nothing before King Saul, so then it would remove any type of antagonism, and then the desire to belittle or kill David in Saul's heart would be satisfied, because he sees Saul is already, he sees Saul seeing that King David is looking at himself like, I'm a dead dog, I'm a flea, I'm nothing. So then that would remove, psychologically, the desire to kill David, because now David's making him out to be something which is nothing. I'm not worth your time. So evidently, King Solomon here is telling us that when it says don't budge, So that might also mean that if a person is the subject of the wrath of a ruler, and of course a ruler knows no competition, he doesn't have to answer to anybody, because by definition, being a ruler, it's his decision. Everything's in his power. He has no opposition. So a person would budge and he would flee. That would just show more guilt, and that might even increase the wrath of the king. So King Solomon says, no, don't move, in the literal sense. But Ebenezer, we'll go in a minute, we'll see how he says, don't move from your wisdom. Which then would answer the question, how does this fit in with the series of verses? Okay, so let's take the Ebenezer. Everybody has the facts, right?
Yep.
Okay. So Ebenezer says as follows. He says, on account of the fact that we mentioned earlier, the words of wisdom are heard more than the shout of a ruler upon fools. That's... That's 9:17. The words of the wise. So even in a pleasant tone are heard more than the shouts of a ruler among fools. So Ibn Ezra says here that on account that we mentioned that earlier, that wisdom is more readily received than the shout of a ruler. So he says that King Solomon continues on that theme. And he says he returns here to warn the wise person that he warns the wise people on the greatness of your wisdom. And he says that if your wisdom brings you up to the level of a ruler, I think he's alluding to Joseph, because from the house of prison he went out to rule. So if the wisdom of a person can elevate him to such a great status, in that case, do not move from, it says, Mimkomcha al Tanach, do not budge from your place. And what does this mean? It means you should still hold on to a humble spirit, or perhaps it means that a person should involve himself in wisdom regularly. Do not ever abandon wisdom, just like at the outset. Meaning, don't let your status be something which removes you from being more dedicated to wisdom. And he says that you should not try to go and use your high status and oppose man, which is this case. I mean, if the king, if for whatever reason, his anger flares against you, so do not go toe-to-toe in terms of argument. And it's a very important rule, because that is something which just infuriates. Because what's the reason why anger of the king is there? Why should he spend his time being angry about what one of his subjects does? So it could be a certain threat of opposition. So if you fuel that by arguing or defending yourself, even if you're right, all that is going to do is confirm what he already is projecting about you, that you're opposing him. And the reason why a person is in power, you have to keep this in mind, they're in power because they want to be in power. They didn't get there by accident. So allow the person, if you want to have peace in your life, you're going to have to play the political game, especially against a ruler that can do you much harm. So deference is something which can, you know, assuage the ruler, that can diffuse the situation. So that's what he says. He says again, don't go up to a higher level and oppose this person. If this is what happens, let the person have their appease them, treat them with respect, just like King David did to Saul, just like Jacob did to Esav. Let them know that they're the boss. That is what they want, and when they see that, then their anger will subside. It's only as long as they feel the threat. So you have to diffuse that by showing no threat. Bow down. Call them a leader, father, whatever the terminology is. Remember Rabbi Chait saying that before the rabbis would be consulting with the political powers that that they may, you know, that have you in any generation, they would review the story of Jacob and Esav. Just to reiterate in their minds the right approach to politics and how humility is essential in terms of, you know, currying the favor of those in power. Then that's a very important thing. Let them know that you recognize them as being the ruler, and you'll get a lot further. Rational arguments are not the right approach at that moment in that scenario. And he says, Vidah. And Ibn Ezra goes on, and he says, no. That if you show humility, if you're soft, if you try to placate, this type of an approach will overcome great sins, meaning great sins that the king can do to you. He goes on, he gives a little bit of linguistics, because he's a very fluent in grammar. And where does he pick up? He goes on, he says, and some say a person who's a doctor, he will abstain from great sins, like, for example, that he won't eat certain things that damage him. So that's the same thing over here. The person will stay away from things that can hurt him. And they explain that if the spirit of this ruler rises against you, do not abandon from seeking wisdom as your recourse. And a really wise person will not anger the ruler. So this is the lesson that he's quoting, that this is Ibn Ezra saying is King Solomon is not telling us. Evidently, there is the disposition of the person that if he is being confronted by the by a ruler, so the typical response might be defense. But this is not what he says to do. Wisdom is something which always runs rules the situation. We talked about this. And it could be he's bringing this example of a ruler because this might be the most stark example to us, you know, that would really shake us up emotionally if we were in that situation and we were confronted by a king. And the emotions might get us, and we might think, and we might invest all of what, you know, we might say that the reality is really bad. The King Solomon says, no. Something runs, is more powerful than this, even a reality like that. And that's wisdom. Meaning, like we said, that there is, the way the world operates is by principles. And human nature is also a principle. So if you understand the underlying motivations, and you understand psychology well, just like you understand how the world works, you have to plant if you want to grow something. You can't just stand idly by and wish. Wishing doesn't put seeds in the ground. So just like the physical world has natural laws, there's certain things that govern. So the same thing applies to the other part of the natural world, which is human nature. So King Solomon's trying to tell you that even in a case where you might be shooken up emotionally, do not budge from your place, which means two things, meaning don't run, don't give in to the fear. That's only going to aggravate in a physical understanding, a plain understanding of the verse. So that shows guilt if you run. But euphemistically, it means that don't leave your adherence to wisdom. And if you follow wisdom, you'll understand what can diffuse the situation. So perhaps that's why. I mean, Ibn Ezra said later on, I believe, that this is really not, that this verse is inserted, and it's not really related to the previous or subsequent verses. Even though he does say it calls back to the end of in chapter 9, 9:17. But where it's couched here, he says, it's not really in a sequence. But it could be, if we want to, we could say that it is. Now he's giving an example of this, the great, because we've been talking the past couple of weeks on the greatness of wisdom, which is what these series of verses are addressing. And here's a great example of how wisdom can resolve even one of the greatest possible catastrophes. If you use wisdom, you can resolve it. Okay, let's stop here, see if there's any questions or comments. Okay, I didn't look at the score yet, so somebody had a question?
Oh, I was going to say, it seems like there's a theme of don't run from the police officer when he pulls you over.
Yeah. And the truth is, if a person is very respectful, he can get out of a ticket that way. But if he sees that he's already superior to you by the fact that you're showing how you're humble, so all of the energy to show his might and his power is satisfied. And then he doesn't have that much more energy to say, you know, he may go in and want to be the nice guy now. I'm going to let you off this time. But if you fight him, he'll give you two tickets instead of one. Again, a police officer chose that profession for a reason.
Can you elaborate on that last statement?
Yeah. Why does a person want a position of power? They want to exert power. A general rule. I'm not talking about every specific case. I'm sure you'll have cases where people have very good motivation. But I would say, in the whole, a person's going into a position of power because he likes power. It's not an accident. So if he's pulling you over, it's a chance for him to exert his power. But if you play like, I'm sorry, you know, I apologize, officer. You give him the right respect of his title, and you show humility, and you don't talk back. So now he looks at you as somebody he already conquered you. So the energy to conquer you by giving you a ticket is not as strong. But if you're opposing him, so then he needs to exert himself more. So then he'll give you a ticket, and he'll give you another ticket. I'll show this guy. But the desire to be in that position where you're wearing uniform, and that has a lot to do with the person's, once he finally gets there, and he's got the camaraderie of other police officers, and he's got the siren, he's got the car, and there's a lot of rules that he can break, under the name of the law. So this is all something you have to realize is feeding the person. You look at Obama so many times also, the way he talks. I mean, it's just a real arrogance. And it's no accident. A person puts all the energy into a campaign. I mean, where's it coming from? There's a real sense of, I deserve this. And when they're finally in that position and they got people under their thumb, that feeds that even more. It's a very powerful emotion. And you can't always hide it. And he doesn't. And I didn't see the Sforno yet, so let's take a look. Let's see what it says. Right, so it says as follows. If the anger of a ruler rises up against you, do not leave your place. That's the verse. Now, what does Sforno say? He says, there are times that you will need to speak upon the heart of a ruler with your wisdom, meaning to calm him. Because, as King Solomon says, deference can assuage the many, many sins that the king could possibly, you know, pose against you. Therefore, the speech of the wise people is a healing thing. And also he says, because a leader will incline his ear to the words of advice. So if you offer counsel, this is something which, again, a king may have ego, but he also has intelligence. And he is also, you know, he has to calculate his moves as well. Now, when he hears a person not just being, not just showing deference to him and respect, but if this content as well, that also, that's what Sforno's adding. He's adding that not only is deference an important thing in terms of emotionally how you present yourself and you don't show any opposition. Additionally, if you have advice, if you have intelligence, that is something which will also appeal to the king, because although he's got anger and he's got the desire to express that power, there's also that's tempered by his desire to maintain his power, which he knows he has to use intelligence for. So he hears something intelligent spoken by this person, that's going to carry some weight with him. And he may not act on the anger because he hears something intelligent. So it's another thing which Ibn Ezra doesn't seem to mention. So there's two things. There's the emotional presentation of the self in front of an angered ruler. There you have to be humble. But also, if you have some content, some advice, that's something. I mean, look what Joseph did, right? He was referred to as the Hebrew, the Ivri. It wasn't, I don't think it was a respectable term when the wine steward had referred to, you know, to him when he told Paro, because Paro was troubled by the dreams. And nonetheless, so he came out, they washed him, they shaved him, they brought him before the king. Of course, the king is not going to show respect for somebody who's in prison. But he was very bothered by his dream, so he was desperate. So he said, I'll even listen to this Hebrew slave. He has some reputation of interpreting dreams. All right, let's give it a shot. But you see that the counsel that Joseph gave was something that rung true in Paro's ears. And you see how that worked, and it turned around the entire situation. He was no longer desperate, not knowing what to do, but now Joseph now gave such great counsel that the king saw in it, you know, a great prospect for the future, how to manage the kingdom successfully. Yeah, Rabbi Chait spoke about the fact that he was giving a resolve to a big problem. Because once he saw that Joseph's interpretation was true, that there was an imminent famine, that's something which can, you know, throw the king, even a great power, even a person very confident, they could throw him into great fear. But then he saw a resolve that Joseph offered, how he could become rich through this whole scenario, store up 7 years of plenty, and then you'll use this as a source of great wealth. You'll come out shining. This won't be a catastrophe, just the opposite. And he saw this, And he saw how wise Joseph was. So his depleted ego was now, you know, he became replete again. And that's, Rabbi Shade explained it, he was so lost without an answer. And his ego was now something he'd built up again by incorporating Joseph into his sense of self. That's why he made Joseph the second in command. In Paro's mind, it was he and Joseph that were now ruling. And this now gave him a sense of self again for the ego. It substantiated his ability to rule. But he was dependent upon Joseph, and he saw what a great mind he was. That's why he took a prisoner and made him a viceroy, made him a second in command. You don't do that unless there's such a need for ego. So Rabbi Chay explained that this is something which helped Paro replenish his ego again, from the state of being at a loss, not knowing what the dreams meant, then seeing that there'd be a famine, and then Joseph gives them resolve, he gives them a plan. So that's why he said, together we'll rule. Now Paro looked at himself and Joseph together. That explains also why later on, when Joseph died, that it said that there arose a new king who did not know Joseph. So there was an argument between the rabbis as whether it was a literal new king, or whether it was the same king with different decrees. So what was forcing one rabbi to say that, no, it was the same Paro? But now, well, why would it say in the verse that there arose a new king that did not know Joseph? If it was the same Paro, how can you not know who Joseph was? So Rabbi Shade explained, according to that side, this is giving you insight into this very, it's adding to that point, that if he replenished his ego because Joseph was around, but now once Joseph died, this threw Paro back into that state of mind where I'm not incapable, you know, I'm incapable now. And I was dependent upon Joseph all this time. And now that Joseph's gone, I'm once again incapable. But he couldn't tolerate that. The ego couldn't tolerate that. So what the mind does is that he makes believe Joseph never existed. There arose a new king that didn't know Joseph, meaning it was the same king according to one rabbi. But since Joseph now died, and now that through this king, this power was now, so his insecurities gripped him again. So the only way out was to make believe Joseph never existed. He acted like Joseph was never around. I never knew him anyway. He washed his hands of him. He had to do that because if he continued with his realization that he's dependent upon Joseph, but now Joseph is dead, what does that do to Paro? It means he's incapable, and he can't tolerate that as being a leader. So he has to deny it. So that was a great insight by that one rabbi. Real beautiful insight that Rabbi Chait showed on that. And it kept with the theme. It explains why Paro would take a prisoner, who's a Hebrew, and make him into the vice president. The same emotion would cause him to deny Joseph ever existed once Joseph dies. So when you have a principle that can explain a number of phenomena, typically it's a true principle. Okay. All right, any questions or comments?
We're good here.
Okay. All right, so for next week, let me just see here. I mentioned about Maimonides. Give me 1 second. Let me see if we can locate that chapter quickly, right? Hold on 1 minute.
Okay.
1 second. Let's see if it locates. Yeah. So if you want to take a look, it's in book, in the Dover edition, it's chapter 17, page 178. There's book two. Yeah. So it's book two, chapter 17. And it talks about how you cannot look at something the way it is now and assume that the properties it has were always that way. So if you want, take a look at it. You can get a hold of it. It is on the Misora site too. So if you go to misora.org/guide.html, you'll find in book 2, chapter 17, and you can read through it. I don't think it's a long chapter. No, it's just a page, two pages. And look through that. And this goes back to a point about how even the philosophers, I believe he says, he's talking about Aristotle and how his view of the universe is based on its origin, he bases it as it is now. But just like we don't look at a human being and say that the way a human being is now, that it, you know, breathes and eats and so on, it always was that way, because it wasn't that way when it's in the womb. So the universe did not have to have that beginning either. So looking at it the way it is now and assessing it as being this way always is a mistake. A very good insight. But take a look at it. Maybe we can discuss this next week. All right, I think this goes into the point that initially was talking to Jim about how people have a view of the universe and God as having to fit into their own categories of space, whereas God is completely removed from that. So to say that God occupies everything, or to say that he had to contract himself to make room for the universe, all this is an outgrowth of a false notion. That's a good chapter to look into. All right? So take a look at that, and we'll discuss it in this week. All right?
Great. Thanks, Rabbi.
Okay, everybody. So everybody have a good week.
Thanks, Rabbi. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks. Bye, everyone. Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.